Hi again, welcome back to the Scandinavian History Podcast with me, Michael Schenkman. Last time, the drama in the Swedish royal family continued when King Eric XIV hardly had time to recover from his mental breakdown before he was robbed of his crown. The driving force behind the conspiracy to oust King Eric was none other than his brother John. The relations between King Eric and John had been frosty for a few years, not least since Eric had locked up John and his wife, executed his associates, and considered handing his wife, the Polish princess Catherine Jagiellon, over to the Russian Tsar. But after King Eric killed off the leading members of the Sture family and some other members of the high nobility, and married his sister's maid, John was able to build a coalition of people who wanted to get rid of Eric, which they did in the last episode. As king, John liked to compare himself to his father, Gustav Vasa. Just like Gustav Vasa had liberated Sweden from the bloodthirsty Christian II, so too John had liberated the country from a dangerous tyrant, namely John's crazy brother. But apart from that, there wasn't much in John's policies as king that reminded people of his legendary father. Episode 82, Catholic Comeback. As we covered already back in episode 79, the Northern Seven Years' War ended in 1568, when both Denmark and Sweden had spent all their resources and couldn't go on fighting anymore. On land, there was no clear winner, and at sea, Sweden had the upper hand. But Denmark definitely won the peace negotiations, not least since the parties who arranged the negotiations were all Danish allies. So Sweden ended up having to return all conquered lands to Denmark, pay a ransom for Elfsborg Castle, and recognize Denmark as the sovereign power on the Baltic Sea. That last provision probably stung, since the Swedish fleet had actually done pretty well in the war. But at least peace had finally returned, and the war-weary Scandinavians could focus on recuperating and rebuilding. As I've already mentioned, Denmark settled into a period of stability, growth, and prosperity for much of what was left of the 16th century. The economy, culture, sciences, and the aristocracy all flourished during Frederick II's remaining years on the throne. In Sweden, though, the situation was far less rosy, primarily because, unlike Denmark, Sweden would not be fortunate enough to enjoy peace in the years following the end of the Northern Seven Years' War. A new war against Russia started more or less immediately after the peace treaty with Denmark had been finalized. The new war with Russia would continue on and off for 25 years, with a predictable effect on the country's finances, not to mention the quality of life for the people living in the affected regions, in this case primarily Estonia and Finland. At least peace had been achieved with Poland before this new war erupted. That was in no small part thanks to the fact that John III had excellent connections in Poland, thanks to his wife, the Polish-born Queen Catherine. At the same time, Catherine was, at least indirectly and by no fault of her own, the reason Sweden and Russia went to war. As I mentioned already last time, Tsar Ivan the Terrible had courted Catherine before she married John, and the Russian ruler clearly couldn't take no for an answer, because he had continued to demand that Eric XIV hand over his sister-in-law to the Tsar. Ivan had made it clear that handing over Catherine to him was a condition for continued good relations between Russia and Sweden, and since King Eric hadn't been interested in a war on the eastern border when he was already fighting the Danes, he hadn't rejected the Russian demands, and instead played for time. The tense relations with Russia were no longer Eric's concern, since he'd been toppled and replaced by his brother John on the Swedish throne. But since John was actually married to Catherine, the chances of her being handed over to the Russian diplomats still waiting around in Stockholm had grown increasingly slim after the coup. In fact, one of the first things John did after he became king in 1567 was to have the Russian delegation arrested, roughed up, and sent packing back to Russia. Perhaps not the smartest diplomatic move in history, but, you know, still relatable. The incident with the Russian diplomats in Stockholm led to some pretty spicy correspondence between King John and Tsar Ivan. John wasn't at all sorry about how he'd treated Ivan's representatives who'd come to kidnap his wife, and he protested about the nature of their mission. In addition, he complained that the Tsar wasn't prepared to treat John as his equal, but insisted that the King of Sweden should negotiate with the governor of Novgorod, the former Viking settlement Holmgård, instead of writing directly to the Tsar, who thought of himself as John's social superior. Ivan responded that John should first send over his wife and children to Russia, only then the Tsar would consider treating him like an equal. Even though John really was just a parvenu on the royal stage, not even of noble blood, but really just of peasant stock. John replied that Ivan's letter was so full of lies, arrogance, and nonsense that if he hadn't known better, he would have thought that Ivan was the son of a Russian Orthodox monk or a peasant, because he wrote as someone who was brought up in lowly, debased circumstances among people without honor. Somewhat surprisingly, John still thought that peace was possible even after he had sent off that last diatribe. In a last-ditch effort to avoid war, he sent a delegation to Russia in 1569, led by the Bishop of Turku. But the Tsar even refused to meet the Swedish diplomats, forcing them instead to present their errand to the governor of Novgorod. The Tsar even demanded that the Swedes admit that the governor was the equal of the Swedish king, but the bishop refused to do so. This led to the governor ordering the Swedish delegation to be apprehended. They were robbed of everything they brought with them, including the clothes they'd been wearing. They were then paraded naked through the streets of Novgorod. After that ordeal was over, the Swedes were presented with a new list of Russian demands if they wanted to avoid war. It was no longer enough for King John to hand over his wife and children to the Tsar. Now, Ivan also demanded that the Swedes hand over Reval, that is modern-day Tallinn in Estonia, provide a force of a few hundred cavalrymen to aid the Russians whenever the Tsar demanded, pay 10,000 thaler in compensation for the disrespectful treatment of the Russians in Stockholm, hand over some silver mines in Finland, close to the Russian border, and allow the Tsar to style himself Lord of Sweden. I can't imagine the Tsar actually believed the Swedes would agree to these demands, and of course they didn't. Most of the Swedish delegates were allowed to return home to pass on the message, but the Bishop of Turku had to stay as the Tsar's prisoner. He would have to spend the coming years in Russian captivity until he was eventually allowed to return home. But by then, the war was already in full swing. Once the fighting started, it went on with breaks for 25 years. The conflict wasn't only about who would be allowed to live with Catherine Jagellon, but also, and perhaps mainly, about who would control which parts of Estonia, Livonia, and the rest of the Baltic region, where the collapsing Teutonic Order had left a power vacuum. Unfortunately, despite the fact that it went on for so long, there were few interesting battles and other dramatic events taking place during this war. It was mostly raiding, plundering, and burning across each other's borders, which is tedious to get a detailed account about on a podcast, not to mention horrible to live through. The fighting, pillaging, and burning was mostly focused on the northern Baltic region. But Finland was used extensively by the Swedes to feed the army, to house the soldiers while recuperating and wintering, and toward the end of the war, Finland was also used to raise new troops. Estonia, where much of the actual fighting took place, couldn't feed or house the troops because the land was so thoroughly plundered and burned. The actual fighting began with a Russian attack into Estonia, trying to take the city of Reval. Russia received help from Denmark, and Danish troops could conveniently be shipped over from the Danish-controlled island of Ösel off the coast of Estonia, where King Frederick II had placed his brother Magnus in charge. Reval was surrounded and put under siege, but even though the siege lasted for 7 months, the defenders managed to hold the city, and eventually the attackers had to withdraw. But the failure to take Reval didn't mean that the Russians had given up their plans to conquer Estonia. In 1572, they came back with a larger army. Some sources say 80,000 strong, but that's obviously an absurd exaggeration. Still, it was large, much larger than anything the Swedes could field in Estonia, or anywhere else for that matter. This large force managed to capture a castle called Weissenstein, where they killed all the Swedish defenders. Some of them, including the commander of the castle, were then roasted alive over an open fire. Grim. This atrocity would unfortunately set the tone for how Swedes and Russians would treat each other as prisoners of war throughout the conflict. Soon after the fall of Weissenstein, all of Estonia fell into Russian hands, with the exception of Reval. Once again, the city held out. The attackers never managed to cut off the city's port, so it could continue to receive supplies from Finland. Speaking of Finland, it was the next target for the Russians. Already in winter 1570-1571, Russian forces were roaming the Finnish countryside, plundering and burning. They weren't trying to conquer and keep any territory permanently. They were just out to destroy as much as they could in order to complicate Swedish maneuvers in the border region. The Russians could act more or less at will. Swedish forces in Finland were weak at the time, and the few soldiers that did exist were concentrated at the castles such as Viborg. Civilians who didn't want to be attacked by the Russians had no choice but to seek refuge in these fortresses. All peasant men were ordered to join the defense of Finland, but they could do little against the Russian soldiers, who were more or less professional. So in the spring of 1571, Swedish troops were shipped across the Baltic Sea to Finland. 8,400 foot soldiers and 2,400 cavalrymen. Eventually, these reinforcements were able to fight off the invaders. In 1573, it was the Swedes' turn to cross the border on a campaign to plunder and burn. Nominally, in retaliation for the burning alive of the Swedish soldiers at Weissenstein Castle. Eventually, though, both sides realized that all this plundering and burning was going to achieve was the desolation of the border zone, so they agreed on a ceasefire. The ceasefire actually held up for a few years, until 1577. It was broken when the Russians once again attacked with a huge force trying to take Reval for a third time. But after a few months and heavy losses, they had to give up again. At the same time, they also attacked the southern Finnish coast, plundering and burning, but were chased off by Swedish defenders. A new phase of the war started in 1580, when the leadership of the Swedish armed forces was replaced and new, more competent military leaders were put in charge. This new strategy of focusing on competence paid off, but to be fair, it didn't hurt that the Russians were also under attack from Poland further to the south, so they had to divide their forces. The Swedes went on the offensive and took Kexholm after only a few days of siege. The town itself burnt down, but the castle survived and was placed under Swedish command. Then Estonia was retaken, bit by bit. In 1581, the Swedes set their sights on the Russian-held town of Narva, on the border between Estonia and Russia. The town fell, and so did several others in the area, expanding Swedish holdings into Estonia and Ingria. In retaliation for the brutal burning of Swedish soldiers at Weissenstein, some 7,000 defeated Russian soldiers were massacred after the capture of Narva. After another round of plundering and burning across the border in both directions, a new ceasefire deal was reached, and it, too, was respected for several years. But in the late 1580s, the Swedish position had become precarious. Poland had signed a peace treaty with the Russians, so the Swedes were on their own again. King John of Sweden was on bad terms with his brother Karl, more on that later, and the royal finances were in horrible shape. He wanted to finish the war, and he hoped that a show of force would scare the Russians into signing a permanent peace deal. So in the summer of 1589, King John went to Reval at the head of a large army that he hoped the Russians would want to avoid fighting at any cost. Maybe that had been a good plan on paper, but as usual, the devil is in the details. The army King John brought with him may have been big, but it was in such bad shape, ill-equipped, untrained, and underfed, that it didn't scare anyone. Instead, it apparently gave the Russians the basically accurate impression that the Swedes were at the brink of collapse. So in early 1590, the Russians launched a double attack, both against Estonia and Finland. So instead of ending, the war was on again. The Russians hoped to retake all the territory they had been forced to give up now when the Poles were out of the picture, and maybe gain some more new ground as well. In January, they crossed the border and reached as far as Reval, on the Estonian side, and Helsinki, on the Finnish side of the Gulf of Finland. By February 25th, the local Swedish governor was forced to sign an agreement to relinquish all the lands east of Narva to the Russians. But when King John heard about this development, he flew into a rage. He wasn't going to accept any of it. The king sent the fleet to Estonia, but the Swedes didn't manage to reconquer any of the lost territory. In 1591, they even made two attempts at taking Novgorod, but they failed both times. Another Swedish campaign tried to reach the White Sea in the north through Karelia. A number of Russian settlements were sacked, but ultimately this campaign failed to make any permanent territorial gains because the Swedish forces weren't large enough to hold on to any of the sacked towns. Instead, some more mutual cross-border plundering and burning followed. Finally, Drawn-out negotiations at a place called Tausina in Ingria led to a peace agreement in May 1595. According to this agreement, called the Eternal Peace at the time, Sweden got to keep Estonia, including Narva, but lost Kexholm and Ingria. The border through Lapland was also decided, but the concrete demarcation, that is the physical placing of stones marking the border through the wilderness, was such a long and logistically complicated process that it wouldn't be completed before the Eternal Peace ended, and Sweden and Russia would find themselves at war yet again. Unlike his father Gustav Vasa, John III was actually keenly interested in religion. During his time in captivity at Gripsholm Castle, he had read a lot of books on theology, and not just any theology, quite a bit of it had been Catholic theology. John's Polish and fervently Catholic wife, Catherine, had encouraged this interest, and leading clerics praised her for her willingness to spread the Catholic message in her new heretical homeland, and supported her in her efforts as best they could. Now when John was king, his interest in all things religious showed. For example, in 1575, he allowed convents to start admitting new novices again, and he promulgated a new church order that included several Catholic elements that had previously been removed by stricter Lutheran theologians. Despite the precarious situation the crown's finances were in because of all the wars, he'd invested a considerable amount of money in the repair, extension, and new construction of churches all over the country. The upkeep of church buildings hadn't been prioritized during the reigns of Gustav Vasa and Erik XIV, who instead had poured the crown's resources into building and expanding castles and fortresses to control the population and defend the realm against invaders. So, even some of the major churches in the country were pretty run down by now, and in desperate need of repairs. Some had even been forced to replace leaking metal roofs with thatched ones. Six cathedrals, Uppsala, Västerås, Linköping, Skara, Turku, and Reval, were renovated, and so were the churches and a number of monasteries in both Sweden and Finland. All the major churches in Stockholm were given an overhaul, and King John even built two new ones, one on the site of a monastery his father, Gustav Vasa, had torn down. John's religious interest was, perhaps due to his wife's influence, or perhaps because of his own personal tastes, leaning towards Catholicism. He found the new Swedish Mass too simple, too cold, too devoid of holiness. He liked the music, the pomp, and the ceremony of the traditional Catholic Mass, and he wanted to bring back some of that to the Swedish Church. To achieve this goal, King John had a new order of service printed in early 1576. It was officially called Liturgia Svecane Ecclesiae Catholicae et Orthodoxe Conformia, but that was a bit of a mouthful, so people just called it the Red Book because its covers were red. This new order of service stressed that the priests needed to bring back a sense of the sacred and of solemnity to the proceedings. For example, they were instructed to stop putting their gloves and hats on the altar, and pointed out that they were to make sure they wore clean wet vestments and washed their hands before celebrating Mass. The fact that these things needed to be said says something about the state of religious life in post-Reformation Sweden. Many previous abolished parts of the Catholic Mass, such as genuflections, were also brought back, but others, like making the sign of the cross and kissing the altar, were still kept out, since they were seen as repugnant to Lutherans. But it would seem that the Red Book was only a temporary measure, and that King John actually entertained the idea of rolling back the Reformation completely and returning Sweden to the Catholic fold. He even entered into negotiations with the Pope about what such a return to the Catholic Church would look like and how it should be done. In the end, though, nothing came of these negotiations. It turned out that the Vatican demanded a full rollback of the Reformation, and a complete reinstatement of the rights and privileges that the Roman Church had enjoyed in Sweden before Gustav Vasa. And not even King John was prepared to go that far. He wasn't prepared to return any substantial amount of land to the Church, and he wasn't willing to give up any of the crown's new power over the Church that the Reformation had brought about. So, at the end of the day, the reason the negotiations between the King of Sweden and the Pope failed was political and financial, not theological. But even if the king and the pope had been able to agree on a compromise, it's far from certain that the re-Catholicization of Sweden had been possible. It would definitely not have been easy. By now, Sweden had been a Lutheran country for a generation, and even though the Reformation had met quite a bit of opposition in the beginning, most people around the country had gotten used to it by now. Only people in their 50s or older even remembered being practicing Catholics, and far fewer people than today lived to see their 50th birthday in the 16th century. In addition, a new Lutheran church hierarchy had been established. They would not have given up their positions without a fight. A number of bishops flat out refused to implement the new order of service described in the Red Book, and as John grew closer to Rome, the opposition at home grew even stronger. One of the most vocal opponents of King John's pro-Catholic reforms was none other than his younger brother Karl. He wanted to keep the Lutheran way introduced during his father's reign, and he refused to implement John's reforms in his own duchy. Remember, Gustav Vasa had given all his sons their own duchies, where they had far-reaching autonomy to do what they wanted, as long as they didn't conduct their own foreign policy and did pay all their taxes. So in Karl's duchy, he could enforce a strict form of Lutheranism, and his lands even became a safe haven for Lutheran priests who fled from other parts of Sweden when the Red Book was introduced and other anti-Lutheran steps were taken. For example, in September 1576, four senior priests in Stockholm, including the principal of the city school, were suspended because they refused to go along with King John's reforms. When this didn't make them fall into line, on the contrary, they actually put together a written protest against the Red Book. Two of them were banished from Stockholm, and they were given new, out-of-the-way positions in the countryside. The third was left alone because he was so old, and the last one fled to the Duchy of Karl. There he was free to practice Lutheranism under the protection of the king's brother. But John's harsh treatment of his opponents didn't stop the protests. Around Christmas, new protests actually flared up in Uppsala, the center of Swedish religion since even before Christianity was introduced, and in January, the king summoned the uncooperative priests to Stockholm to have a Jesuit try to convince them of the error of their ways. Perhaps not completely surprisingly, this failed, but the king was nevertheless determined to push on with his pro-Catholic agenda. A Riksdag had been called, and representatives of the four estates flocked to Stockholm in the coming weeks. Since the theologians from Uppsala hadn't been swayed, the king had them apprehended and removed from the city. They were to be locked up at Svartsjö Castle and other places, where they couldn't try to influence the Riksdag to vote against the king's reforms. This tactic actually worked, and on February 11th, the three secular estates, that is the nobility, the burghers, and the peasants, voted in favor of introducing the Red Book all over the country. Only the priests voted against, but that didn't help. They were outnumbered, and once the king had won the vote, the prisoners were released. But to King John's chagrin, it soon turned out that the vote in the Riksdag had been a hollow victory. The Red Book was only readily implemented in Westrogothia. Most other bishops did what they could to delay or stop the implementation of the reforms. The fact that members of the Catholic Jesuit order had come to Sweden and were now moving about and working freely and openly irked many of the Lutheran priests, who saw the Jesuits as a symbol of the Counter-Reformation that had formed in the Catholic world as a reaction to Lutheranism. The Archbishop himself, who had supported King John, changed his mind toward the end of his life in 1579, citing the permission for Jesuits to enter Sweden as the reason for rejecting the king's neo-Catholic reforms. After the negotiations with the Vatican had collapsed, you might have thought that King John would have given up on his religious agenda. But the opposite was actually true. In the 1580s, he stepped up his efforts to implement the Red Book all over Sweden, ordering that priests who didn't follow it shouldn't be paid, and even threw some prominent priests in jail for refusing to go along with the new order of service. The number of priests who escaped to the Duchy of Karl in order to continue to practice Lutheranism in peace grew, and it even included a bishop who the king ousted because of his refusal to use the Red Book. Karl gave him a new job in the town of Nyköping, southwest of Stockholm. At a new Riksdag in 1582, King John forced the priests to approve the Red Book, and the following year all bishops met in Uppsala for the consecration of the new archbishop, who was loyal to the king and his agenda. Did I say all bishops? My mistake. The Bishop of Strängnäs stayed away since he refused to accept the new religious policy, and he was safe to express his opposition since Strängnäs was located in the Duchy of Duke Karl. It doesn't take much to imagine that King John was far from thrilled that his brother challenged him so openly on this issue, one that was so close to the king's heart. But there wasn't much he could do. Gustav Vasa had established these autonomous duchies for his sons, and Karl was free to do what he liked. In 1586, the temperature of the religious conflict between the king and the duke rose even further when Karl issued a declaration stating that no religious ceremony or service that didn't conform to the Lutheran standard set before King John's backsliding reforms would be valid in his duchy. The following year, the priests of the duchy met and formally rejected the king's new semi-Catholic liturgy expressed in the Red Book. Karl even invited four prestigious, but crucially Lutheran, German theological faculties to give feedback on the Red Book. In a shocking verdict, all these Lutheran institutions rejected it as full of Catholic fallacies and papist nonsense. All of this infuriated the king. John, who was Gustav Vasa's son after all, let the infamous Vasa temperament show. He declared all the priests in Karl's duchy to be outlaws, meaning that anyone who encountered them would be free to kill them without risking any legal repercussions. He also stepped up the arrests of priests and theologians throughout the country who had expressed their opposition to the Red Book. But not everybody hated the Red Book and the king's efforts to make Sweden a little more Catholic. If anything, John's wife, the Polish-born Queen Catherine, would probably have wanted him to go further. And even though the rollback of the Reformation in Sweden wasn't exactly going smoothly, she was probably confident that the future looked bright for Catholicism in Sweden. You see, their eldest son and the heir to the throne, Sigismund, was raised a Catholic, and he would almost certainly continue his father's religious policies. Sigismund was also connected to his mother's country of origin, culturally and politically. His involvement in Polish affairs was so extensive that he managed to get elected King of Poland in 1587. Poland was a rich and advanced country, considerably richer and more advanced than Sweden in the 16th century, so one can only assume that Sigismund, known as Sigismund III as King of Poland, was happy to be king of it. His elevation did create some tension in Sweden, though, because this meant that when Sigismund's father, the by now elderly King John, would kick the bucket, the Catholic King of Poland would also be King of Sweden. This new union irked a lot of people in the leading Swedish circles. Even though King John had worked hard to maneuver his son into the top job in Poland, he actually soon changed his mind and wanted Sigismund to return to Sweden. But the high nobility and its representatives on the Council of the Realm were dead set against it. They were afraid that it could potentially lead to war with Poland, and after a quarter of a century of near constant war, Sweden frankly wasn't equipped to handle yet another one. But King John was adamant that he wanted his son to return to Sweden. Unfortunately for the king, the only thing he achieved by insisting was to isolate himself from the nobility, the political force that he had leaned against and where he'd found his strongest political support ever since they had funded his coup against his brother Erik XIV. So John spent his last years increasingly alone and isolated. He had lost the support of the aristocracy, his son and heir lived far away in Poland, and he was involved in an increasingly acrimonious conflict over religion with his own brother, Karl. When the king eventually died in 1592, he left behind a realm brought to the brink of bankruptcy because of a long and ruinous war against Russia, and teetering on the brink of civil war due to a religious conflict the king had started, but it lacked the strength or decisiveness to finish. But at least the country's churches had received a badly needed facelift. Next time, we'll see how John's surviving family picked up the pieces of the mess he'd made, and then immediately proceeded to throw said pieces at each other. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Scandinavian History Podcast, whatever your opinion about the Red Book may be. If you did, why not spread the word wherever you congregate with others who are into Scandinavian history? Also, please consider leaving a stellar review, or at least 5 stars, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, where you can rate podcasts nowadays. This is an excellent way to attract new listeners and to support the show. Another good way to support the show is to purchase some Scandinavian history-themed merch in the Scandinavian History Podcast webshop. I especially recommend something from the Odin's Lifehack collection. It's a line of merch with quotes from Havamal, accredited to the King of the Gods. You can get t-shirts, mugs, tote bags, and many other items with nuggets of Scandinavian wisdom, such as, "Wake up early if you want another man's land or life," "Only fools hope to live forever by avoiding enemies," or "Speak useful words or be silent." Links to these amazing products and more can be found on the Scandinavian History Podcast Facebook page. If you haven't already, then please go to facebook.com/Scandinavian History Podcast. Like and follow the page if you want to shop or if you just crave more content, at least vaguely related to Scandinavian history. Via the Facebook page, you can also send me questions or angry messages about things I've said or not said on the show. If you prefer the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, you can follow me and send me messages at Schenkman. That is S-H-A-I-N-K-M-A-N. I look forward to hearing from you.